It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if the idea of organizing your junk drawer or going through your unmatched socks sounds satisfying to you, you're not alone. A lot of people feel better after doing some cleaning and organizing. A Wisconsin psychologist tells us why housework can help us feel more calm. First, it's not getting as much attention as the races for governor or U.S. Senate, but the campaign for Wisconsin's attorney general is still a big deal. Republican incumbent Brad Schimmel is running for a second term. He's being challenged by Josh Call, a Democratic attorney from Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio has profiles on both of the candidates. First, here's Laurel White's report on Attorney General Brad Schimmel.
When the governor and state legislature created Wisconsin's new Office of School Safety in the Department of Justice this year, they gave Schimmel plenty to talk about. He's visited school after school, announcing awards from the office's new $100 million grant program.
When the tragedy of Parkland, Florida happened, we had a plan and we were ready to work together.
It's become a staple of his reelection message. So has the DOJ's work fighting the opioid epidemic.
And Wisconsin is leading the nation in our efforts to battle this opiate crisis.
Schimmel, who's a Republican, has done dozens of public events on those two issues, which are typically seen as fairly bipartisan. He's also touted his endorsement by bipartisan groups of Wisconsin sheriffs and district attorneys, which he says shows he can and has reached across the aisle. Zach Rode is the communications director at the Republican Attorneys General Association, which has spent heavily on Schimmel's reelection campaign.
When you're law enforcement's choice, including Democrat law enforcement, I think that sends a message that they want you back in office. You've earned it.
But not everyone agrees that Schimmel has kept politics out of the office. In August, 45 assistant attorneys general signed a letter saying that Schimmel has been too political. Many have also spoken out about morale being low at the DOJ. Dan Steer worked for two state attorneys general in the 1970s and 80s, one a Democrat and the other a Republican. He said those who signed the letter have seen a lot of AGs come and go, but they've never felt the need to speak out like they did against Schimmel.
He has blatantly politicized the office. There's no question about that in our minds. Everything is done for partisan reasons.
Schimmel has also come under attack from Democrats for keeping Wisconsin out of a lawsuit against opioid manufacturers. Instead, he says he's working to get an out-of-court settlement from the companies. Schimmel says that option is quicker and cheaper for both parties.
We hope that they're going to see that and take advantage of an opportunity to have positive public relations by being part of the solution.
But Schimmel has received more attention in this campaign for a case he has joined, a multi-state suit that seeks to overturn the Affordable Care Act. It's a lawsuit Schimmel has admitted would end the federal mandate for insurance coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. That mandate is very popular in Wisconsin. But he says the Affordable Care Act is failing, and his lawsuit would prevent what he called a slow bleed.
The ACA is falling, and it's not anything to do with what any court does. It's failing. All of the promises that were made are not coming true.
Schimmel has also taken criticism from the left for some of his spending in office. That includes $10,000 spent on commemorative coins for the Department of Justice staff. The coins got some national attention from the HBO show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
If you live in Wisconsin, just Google Brad Schimmel $10,000 coins and you'll learn about how your AG managed to spend 10 grand of taxpayer money on coins reading KAED, which stands for his actual personal motto, kicking ass every day.
Schimmel has defended the coins, saying they reward law enforcement heroes that keep people safe. He says his endorsements show he's the choice of law enforcement and hopes voters take notice. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Laurel White.
And I'm Sean Johnson. Josh Call announced he was running for attorney general back in April of last year. He's been regularly name-dropped by high-ranking Democrats, including Congressman Mark Pocan.
I have not been this excited about a new face in politics in a long time. Josh Call is going to make a great attorney general for Wisconsin.
That was back at the state party convention in June. And yet, in the closing days of his campaign, polling suggests many voters are still learning about Call. He started running ads a few weeks ago to introduce himself.
I'm Josh Call. As a federal prosecutor, I put away murderers and drug traffickers, and now I'm running for attorney general.
Call was an assistant U.S. attorney in Baltimore. He's emphasized that experience in tough-on-crime ads that are mainstays of attorney general races. Call spent fewer than 4 years as a federal prosecutor. Most of his professional experience is in private practice.
Every place he's been, he's kind of just risen very quickly toward the top.
Chuck Curtis works with Call at Perkins Coie, a national law firm with strong ties to the Democratic Party. He says he first met Call 15 years ago when they worked together at another law firm while Call was still in law school. Curtis says Call has succeeded everywhere, including at Yale and Stanford Law. He worked with Call in 2016 on a lawsuit that overturned several Republican-authored voting laws in Wisconsin, including restrictions on early voting. Curtis says Call has handled voting rights cases in other states, including Ohio, Virginia, and North Carolina.
He's one of the go-to, you know, voting rights lawyers, and he's been pulled in precisely because he is so good at what he does, and he is so talented in the courtroom.
Call says if he's elected attorney general, he'll join other states in lawsuits that protect consumers. Call says he would have joined a multi-state lawsuit that seeks to reinstate rules that prevent large broadband companies from blocking or slowing access to certain websites. And he says the state should have joined a multi-state suit involving private colleges.
When protections for students who are defrauded by predatory for-profit colleges were rolled back, a number of AGs stepped up and took action, but our AG was nowhere to be found.
Call knows what the Department of Justice can do. He's the son of the late Peg Lautenschlager, Wisconsin's former attorney general. But Call's campaign has been less about him than it's been about Attorney General Brad Schimmel. Call says Schimmel made mistakes by joining multi-state lawsuits to overturn the Affordable Care Act, clean air rules, and federal overtime protections.
So our AG, with our tax dollars, has fought against overtime pay for middle-class families in Wisconsin.
Call has also gone after Schimmel for not moving more quickly on dealing with thousands of untested rape kits while prioritizing other cases. Schimmel announced in September that his office had eliminated the backlog. He's played up his own experience as a prosecutor in the Waukesha County District Attorney's Office and the Department of Justice. When the two debated, Schimmel pressed Call on his lack of experience as a prosecutor in Wisconsin.
How many times have you made a closing argument to a jury in a criminal case?
So far, Call hasn't flinched, sticking to his strategy. Call, who's 37, has risen fast in the world of law. Voters will decide Tuesday whether he takes the next step in politics. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Sean Johnson.
You can join WPR tomorrow night for live election coverage. NPR reports on national races starting at 7. And when polls close here in Wisconsin at 8, Sean Johnson and I will be here with Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg for coverage of statewide elections, including those races for governor, U.S. senator, and attorney general. We'll be here throughout the night with election results and analysis. That's live election night coverage starting Tuesday night at 7 on WPR. Coming up, if you find your house is at its cleanest when you're at your most anxious, you might be one of the world's many stress cleaners. A psychology professor tells us why cleaning up can help us calm down. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows teens aren't sleeping well, and many are turning to medications and alternative remedies for help. We'll look at the problem and the risks of not getting enough sleep. First, does scrubbing your kitchen floor or washing all the mirrors in your house make you feel just a little bit happier? Or maybe you find yourself cleaning out the fridge before a job interview. Seems like a lot of us find ourselves doing some sort of cleaning or organizing task when we're feeling anxious or upset. But why? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does cleaning your kitchen, organizing something, maybe doing some vacuuming make you feel better? Do you find yourself cleaning to procrastinate? Is there some kind of mood boost or feeling of satisfaction after you clean up a living space? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the UW Green Bay. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Well, we asked our listeners on Facebook, Regan, if cleaning helped them relax when they feel stressed or anxious. We got a lot of answers. Janice said when her house is messy and dirty, it causes her stress and anxiety. After she straightens it up and cleans, she feels better. She doesn't feel better while she's doing it. Regan, a lot of people have some kind of association between cleaning and stress and anxiety. What's that all about?
And Rob, I think you and Janice used the key word, which is the association. And what research shows is that there is definitely an association between stress and cleaning. Which direction that association goes, that's where we really need to explore it some more. So very often, I think you'll hear, and you know, there was this article that came out just a month ago in media and social media that said, you know, why does cleaning make someone feel less anxious? Well, interestingly enough, as I read through that article, I realized that all the research that it talked about actually didn't show that at all. What it showed is the other direction, which is when we are anxious, when we are stressed, we tend to clean more. Now, I think we can sort of guess why cleaning can help out, but right at the onset, I wanted to say this is an association. Mm-hmm. What's causing what is something that we still need to unpack, and there's a little bit of research on the maybe cleaning helps, but a lot more research suggesting that when we get anxious, we clean. So much so that now if you look around and you see somebody who's suddenly cleaning more, there's a pretty good chance that without even asking them, that person is actually stressed. So really, really neat research there showing that as stress increases, our tendency to clean actually increases as well. And then anecdotally, it seems like when we do clean, we do feel better. And I think there are some really neat other psychological reasons why that may be the case. Well, a really fascinating little interaction there.
Let's get into the reasonings behind why anxiety might make us clean. One idea I've seen is that, okay, part of anxiety is feeling like you are out of control or you don't have control over key things in your life. Here, cleaning, organizing, there's this one small way to exert control over your surroundings. Is there something to that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there are a couple of, you know, different things that relate to that. Firstly, from an evolutionary standpoint, it seems to be that whenever we get stressed, if we do something that's a ritualized behavior or do something ritualistic, that helps us feel better. So, for example, there was a study that showed that this was a really neat study where in the lab, they actually made people stressed, and they used the classic lab technique, which is they told them, hey, you're going to do some public speaking. Most of us don't like public speaking. So they stressed out one group of people, said, hey, you're going to do some public speaking. The other group was sort of the comparison group, weren't stressed out. And then they gave all the people something to clean. And I know that sounds sort of crazy, but they gave people something to clean, and they measured how much they cleaned, how much they rubbed, how much repetition. And lo and behold, those people who were stressed more, who thought they were going to do some public speaking, actually rubbed this object with the cleaning cloth more than the other people. With the suggestion that if we do something that's a ritualistic, habitual type of behavior, it makes us feel better. And I think part of that is the control. And I think a large part of that is sort of the way it focuses our mind away from the stressor and something very specific that, as you mentioned, we do have a lot of control over. You know, if I have a messy desktop, if I clean up my desk, wow, there's a sense of accomplishment. It's low-hanging fruit. Really quickly, I can say, wow, look what I've accomplished. And I think all that goes together.
We do a lot of things. We feel anxious. We might eat junk food. Guilty, I've done that. Or worse, we might drink more or use other addictive substances more. There are a lot of negative ways we deal with our stress or anxiety. So given the options out there, even if the cleaning isn't necessarily a cure, is it so bad?
Well, I think, you know, even I'm going to go beyond that. One of the reasons that I think cleaning is great is the way that it maps onto most techniques of mindfulness and meditation. Now, a lot of people hear mindfulness, meditation, they go, oh, no, I'm not into that. I'm not into yoga, even though a lot of people are into yoga, which is good. But if you notice the elements of cleaning, focusing on one task and only focusing on that task, really map onto mindfulness. If you are cleaning, both your hands are cleaning, you're not using your technology, you're not, as much as possible, you're focusing on getting that area clean, well, that focus on the task automatically is making you less likely to think about all those things that stress you out. So at the core, when you take a look at many mindfulness techniques, the cognitive and the physiological correlates of a mindfulness technique actually map on almost directly onto cleaning. So, wow, you know, you can kill many birds with the same stone, reduce your stress, apparently, and also actually get your house clean.
We're talking to Regan Gurung, psychology professor at UW Green Bay, talking about why a lot of us clean and organize around the house when we're feeling anxious, when we're feeling stressed. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Kenosha. Michelle, hello.
Hi. Hello, how you doing?
Good. What's your story, Michelle?
Hi. I relate to this because I've been actually cleaning my house, getting ready to move. And it's because of this, you know, thing I just went through that's emotional. And this is my question. My question is, why is that feeling only temporary? Like, it is a distraction, you know, from how you're feeling. But I've noticed once I stop doing those things, I no longer feel any better.
Michelle,
and
thanks.
And I'm wondering, is that a temporary satisfaction, like a temporary, like, distraction and not a long-lasting psychological result?
I gotcha, Michelle. Thanks a lot for the call. Regan, we might feel that meditative break from whatever's bothering us, but then we're done cleaning. Then what's next?
Right. So two things here. I mean, the reason for the short term in maybe in this particular case, but in many other cases, is that as long as we are cutting down on the number of thoughts that are competing for our attention, we feel better. And when that focus is taken away, well, those thoughts have an opportunity to come back. So in the first case, that's why in general some of these techniques tend to be short term. The solution, though, and this is the same for many mindfulness techniques, is that the more we practice that mindfulness, the longer term the effects are. So in Michelle's case, Michelle, it may have been, you know, in this particular case, you found it didn't go too long, but you will actually notice that the longer you practice that kind of distraction, that kind of mindfulness on a single task, you may see that the effects tend to get longer and longer. And that's why people who practice mindfulness for a long period of time, whose practice spans years, actually can have those periods last for a very long time indeed.
Michelle, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your story. We'll go next to Josh in Wausau. Josh, hello.
Hello.
Do you do this? Do you do this cleaning when you're stressed?
Yes. Yes, I've suffered from anxiety for quite a while now, a few years, and my comment was, I feel like a lot of this is happening to people more often because of the way technology is nowadays. You know, a couple hundred years ago, everyone had a task, you know, whether it's farming or taking care of the kids at home, and it was always physically demanding, and we always were able to do that. But now when you have people sitting 10 hours at a computer or in an office, I feel like we're more prone to having anxiety and anxious moments. So we just start cleaning and doing, well, any type of physical activity. And I feel like it's, I mean, helpful in a way to get stuff like that done. But a lot of people might not be aware of how great it is to actually do something physical with your hands and you know, get rid of stress like that.
Josh, thanks a lot for the call. And I feel that, Regan, sometimes when I do something housey, you know, cooking or cleaning or something like that, I definitely notice that it's not just that I'm doing that thing, it's that I have taken that break from the technology and I've stood up and little things like that.
Well, and I think Josh nailed it with mentioning the physical aspect of it. I mean, I just raked leaves this morning, and it felt great to not only just focus on the leaves, but actually feel the muscles of your body doing something. So it's not just putting down that technology, but cleaning, raking, those kind of chores actually are getting your blood going. And a large part of the stress response is dealing with the physiology of stress. And I think cleaning and you know, chores take that aspect into account.
Fantastic. Josh, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Dara in Madison. Dara, do you do this?
I do. I'm a college student, and I clean houses to make a little bit of extra money, and I enjoy it because it's quiet, but also I do find myself procrastinating because I'm like, I don't want to do my homework, and I'll, like, clean my bathroom, and then all the dishes need to be done, and then it's 9 o'clock, and I'm like, oh, man.
But, Dara, I want to ask, like, a lot of people say they're procrastinating, but what's happening below the surface is maybe their brain is working on that problem. Do you feel after you clean and procrastinate, maybe you're ready to tackle that assignment with a fresh eye?
I definitely feel like that.
Cool. Dara, thanks a lot for sharing that. Regan, procrastinating by cleaning, not necessarily such a bad thing either.
Right. You know, and to take what you said, Rob, just a step further, for all of you listening who tend to procrastinate by cleaning or settling, here's a little tip that can make a big difference. Instead of straight away cleaning and then saying I'll do my homework or that task later, actually do the homework or start on the task and do it for a short amount of time and then switch to the cleaning. Because two things can happen. Sometimes once you actually start doing something, you may find that, okay, then you've started, you may as well continue. But even better, getting to the sort of incubation that you talked about, if you start a task and then go clean, while you're cleaning, you're really, your mind is at some non-conscious level going to be working on that task even more, so that when you go back to it, you'll find that you may have had insights that you wouldn't have had if you didn't take that cleaning break.
Dara, thanks for that call. We heard from Christine on Facebook. Christine says she does her best cleaning when she's mad. It helps her release anger in a positive way. How about that anger management through housework, Regan?
You know, the thing with anger management, one of the biggest things is that really taking some time away from the source of the anger is the key. Now, interestingly enough, there have been studies done where whether you are just taking lying down and doing nothing, taking a walk or cleaning, they are all equivalent in how you feel, with the big thing being you are not focusing on that anger object. You are taking a break from it. And I think cleaning is one of those things where automatically will force you to move away from that object. So it's not so much, ooh, I'm working out my anger, but it's actually giving you a nice break from what you're angry about.
And Regan, as we wrap up, a lot of people will be anxious about Election Day tomorrow across the political spectrum. Are we going to see a lot of clean houses in the next couple of days, do you think?
Well, I'm definitely going to be looking around my neighborhood to see if there's more raking going on.
All right. Regan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. You're welcome, Rob.
Regan Gurung is the Ben Jay and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us to talk about why cleaning makes some of us, a lot of us apparently, feel less anxious or stressed, or vice versa, why we, when we're anxious or stressed, want to do some cleaning. Coming up, a new study shows that more than a quarter of teens use some kind of medication to help them sleep, and a lot more just aren't getting enough rest. We'll get the details and why it's a problem after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, American sanctions against Iran went into effect today. We'll talk about what the Trump administration wants to get out of the move and how it's affecting the international community. First, a new study shows that teenagers aren't getting enough sleep. Aside from just being tired, lack of sleep can pose serious long-term health risks. And more than 25% of parents said their teens use some kind of medication to help them sleep. The vast majority of parents of teens with sleep problems said they or their teens had not talked to a doctor about those issues. So why aren't teenagers sleeping well, and what can we do about it? Sarah Clark is an associate research scientist in the Department of Pediatrics and Communicable Diseases at the University of Michigan. She's the co-director of the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital National Poll on Children's Health. She's from Stevens Point, by the way. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob. Proud Splash Panther here.
All right. Well, we see these recommendations all the time. Teens should be getting 8 to 9 hours of sleep-ish. What do we know about how much sleep teenagers are actually getting?
They're getting way less than that. And one of the things that we wanted to do in our poll was to understand from parents what the reasons were for that inadequate sleep. And parents had a number of culprits. And I don't think it's going to surprise anyone to hear that the number one cause that parents gave was that the teens wouldn't get off their electronics, the social media, the cell phones, and things like that. But I want to be fair to the teens, because other leading causes were irregular sleep schedules, sometimes due to the homework load, as well as worry about school and worry about social life. And when you think about how different it is for teens today compared to maybe when you and I were teenagers, that technology is not only a more integral part of the teen's social life, how they're interacting with their peers, but it's also very integrated into their academic life. So teens might be doing a group project that requires them to be communicating with their group partners through social media. They might have online textbooks that require them to be on the computer. They might need to upload their assignments through some sort of software. So this isn't as easy a problem as just saying, hey, let's pull the plug on the technology and we're going to be okay. I don't think that's very realistic.
Before we dig deeper into the results of the survey, can you talk about what's at stake? Why, for teens in particular, is sleep so important?
There are so many reasons that sleep contributes to your daily functioning. You know, certainly there is just the day-to-day ability to concentrate in class. Your mood is greatly affected by sleep, being able to interact with your peers and your family, to feel good about yourself. Then there are some longer-term consequences with sleep being associated with things like obesity. So our bodies require sleep to function at their best, and there are too many teens as well as adults who aren't getting enough sleep.
You also asked parents if their teens were using some kind of sleep aid, whether that's over-the-counter remedies, alternative remedies, or prescription medications. What did you find out?
We did find out that a lot of teens who are having either frequent sleep problems, which we called it three or more nights a week, or occasional sleep problems, maybe one or two nights a week, are trying to address their sleep problems with some sort of product. So we had about 16% using some sort of over-the-counter sleep medicine, and that's the PM formula of products that we're used to seeing day-to-day. About 14% used over-the-counter antihistamines like a Benadryl to try to go to sleep, and 5% use prescription sleep medicine. But what was really interesting, we thought, from our poll results, was that when you looked at the subset of parents who said they and their teen had talked with the doctor about it, the doctor's recommendations were flipped. The doctors were more inclined to suggest the prescription sleep medicine when they felt medication was necessary, and the doctors veered away from that over-the-counter sleep medicine or Benadryl or something like that to address a sleep problem. So there's really a mismatch in what parents are doing kind of on their own and what they're doing in consultation with a health professional.
We're talking about teens and sleep. Many teens are not sleeping enough. A new survey tried to get to the bottom of why that is, what families are doing and not doing to deal with it. Sarah Clark is with us from the University of Michigan. She's an associate research scientist in pediatrics and communicable diseases. And Sarah, you mentioned families talking to the doctor. One thing a lot of families aren't doing when there's a sleep problem in the home, it sounds like, is talking to their doctor.
Unless the parent or the teen brings it up, that's a topic that is likely to be just forgotten about. It's not something that we can assume the child's provider is going to ask about every time. It's interesting that sleep is so important to our overall health, but for a lot of people, they don't think about sleep as a health issue. I think a lot of folks just think about inadequate sleep as something that happens as part of your life. But when a family doesn't bring it up with the doctor, we are taking away the opportunity to, first of all, go through the process of trying to figure out whether this is a situation that has an underlying medical cause. So certainly there are teens as well as adults who have things like sleep apnea that need to have a a very prescribed treatment, or sometimes sleep problems can be a side effect of medication. So once we either identify whether there's this underlying cause or we rule it out, then we can begin to address other things like what are some strategies to help teens sleep better and for longer hours.
That's on the parent side. Are you hoping more healthcare providers ask this, put it on the checklist when they're dealing with teens?
That's one of the things that we try to do with our Mott poll reports, is to get this out into the public on shows like this and or in other media, to make sure that providers remember this is so common for our teenage patients. We need to make sure that we're remembering to ask about that and to offer some really practical suggestions.
Now, I've talked to sleep experts before, and one thing people talk about is, okay, maybe before we go for a medication, working on sleep hygiene. Is that something you looked at in this survey, or that you look at as you're publicizing the results?
We absolutely did look at it in our survey, and sleep hygiene was certainly the most common strategies that doctors were recommending when parents went to see them. And so for folks listening, sleep hygiene includes really practical suggestions like turning off electronics, keeping the room cool, having a set time to go to bed, and a set time to wake up rather than skimping during the week and sleeping till noon in the on a weekend morning. The problem with this particular age group is that sleep hygiene doesn't necessarily fit well with the standard teenage schedule. So if you think about the life of a busy teenager who might come home from play practice or the game or the church group and get home at 9:30, start eating dinner and pull out homework after homework after homework assignment, it's hard to predict the time that they're going to be able to finish up for the night. And I think that contributes to the inadequate sleep that so many of our teens are getting. Sleep hygiene doesn't always work well with their busy lives.
On that topic of the schedule, Brandy on Facebook wrote about the school start times. Teenagers are not meant to get up early. It's just not in their biology. And we've heard recommendations that, hey, maybe we're making kids go to school too early, and that's adding to that scheduling problem you were just talking about. Do you see that as part of the problem?
Absolutely. I can tell you that our own district here in Ann Arbor tried to change the start times, push those start times back a little later. And it really was a challenging situation with reconfiguring the bus schedules. Certainly after school activities, had to reschedule and try to work around different time slots to make that happen. And we also have seen broader movements. There's been a push in the state of California to have a statewide change to a later start time. It's hard to make the logistical changes necessary to do that, but it's such an important health-related situation for our teens that we really need to make the effort.
We're talking to Sarah Clark. She's an associate research scientist in the Department of Pediatrics and Communicable Diseases at the University of Michigan. She also runs the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital National Poll on Children's Health. The latest poll shows that 28% of teens are using some kind of sleep aid, a medication over the counter, what have you, to help them sleep. Three quarters of those haven't talked with their doctors about it. And as we know, a lot of teens aren't getting the recommended 8 or 9 hours a night. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a sleepy teen or a sleepy teenager yourself? Have you or your family used some kind of medication to help out? Have you talked to a doctor about the problem? Is technology part of the story here? Is scheduling, overscheduling, too much homework, too many activities part of the story for your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about teens and their sleeping troubles. Sarah Clark is our guest. She's an associate research scientist in the Department of Pediatrics and Communicable Diseases at the University of Michigan. She's also co-director of the National Poll on Children's Health from the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a teenage child with sleeping issues? Are you a teenager with sleeping issues? Or do you think back to your teen years and think, yeah, this sounds like me. I didn't sleep enough. What was going on? Was it was there medication or other herbal supplements that you used to help out? Did you talk about this with a doctor? And why do you think we as a society have a problem getting our teenagers to sleep enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go to your calls now. We've got Dan with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Dan, hi.
How you doing there, buddy?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I just, you know, I have three teenage boys. They're pretty good kids. And sure, they're tired sometimes, but they're 12, 14, and 16. And we don't live on a farm, but I just think the whole wide world's getting too soft and cushy and easy on kids these days. I think they, you look at a 90-year-old man, all he ever did is talk about milking cows before he went to school every morning and coming home and doing chores and homework and then going to bed. I think you just train yourself to do, be a great big boy. And then these kids, they all talk back to their parents these days. And
all right, Dan, we can go on for a while on that. But Dan's point, Sarah, it sounds like teens aren't getting, among other things, enough physical activity. We're not doing enough to get them tired out by bedtime.
You know, I think Dan's got an excellent point around that. Including a well-balanced, healthy lifestyle is a lot of physical activity. I grew up in Stevens Point. There's a lot of farmland around it, and I think that the getting up early part was also often accompanied by the going to bed a little earlier part, too, for those kids. I do want to mention, though, one other element that parents might be concerned about related to inadequate sleep in teens. It's also less safe driving. And again, I would also say that's probably true for adults too. But if you have teens that are trying to get to school, driving themselves early in the morning, maybe driving a few of their classmates, and they're on the road and they're a little sleepy, or they're driving home late after a late practice or game, that's a risk factor for car crashes or other situations that we don't want to see.
Dan, thanks for that call. Going out to Mike on the line in Sheboygan. Mike, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Mike?
I wanted to talk about the researcher had said that teens aren't biologically set up to wake up in the morning. I find that really hard to believe. You know, I was a teen. I woke up in the morning. Lots of my friends woke up in the morning. The difference probably was is we weren't playing video games till midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. We had all had bedtimes when we were in schools, and when you went to bed, you got your 8 hours of sleep. I think some of the problem might be the fact that society wants to let teens just do if you want to stay up till 1 o'clock and play video games, then that's what you should be able to do. And it's not, you are biologically set to wake up at 6 a.m.
Got it, Mike. Thanks for the call. I don't know if you were saying that it's impossible for teens to wake up early, but that idea of setting bedtimes and not letting that technology or whatever keep teenagers up late, Sarah.
Well, and I agree with Mike in that in no way is our work meant to give kids a free pass to stay up till 1 or to let parents think that that's the appropriate way to run your household. There is pretty good research to show that your natural rhythms, like if you allowed yourself to wake up without an alarm clock, just when you do, it shifts it during adolescence. It shifts a little bit later. So it's not 3 hours later, but it might be 30 to 45 minutes. So there is a natural component of it, and in no way does that excuse having a regular bedtime. I will say I have two sons who are in their early 20s. Their high school activities ran a little later than I remember back in my day. And so one of the things that we want to make sure people think about is look at the child's whole schedule. And if that load of activities is pushing consistently later and later into the night, coupled with a homework load that makes a regular bedtime at a reasonable hour at a 10 o'clock or 10:30 just out of the question, then it's time to really think about what is your child's total bucket of activities, and maybe it's time to talk about cutting back on something.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about teens and sleep. Mostly they're not getting enough. Sarah Clark is with us from the University of Michigan. Back to your calls now. Jeanette is on the line in Walworth. Jeanette, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Well, here's what I would suggest. I happen to be a music teacher and for over 30 years now. And in our district, they have me at the elementary and at the junior high. So in order for the little kids to be most awake and alert for their reading, writing, and math blocks, I don't teach music generally in the morning until later. But I'm up at the middle school in the morning because that's when they're most groggy, and when they wake up, they're alert and ready for their core activities. So I would suggest if they can't change the schedule bus-wise and everything else, that they at least take a look at maybe changing the academic offerings for later times for the junior high and high school and earlier times for the elementary.
And Jeanette, you don't mind teaching music to sleepy middle schoolers?
Well, you know, they behave wonderfully.
Fantastic. Jeanette, thanks a lot for sharing that. So Sarah, she's saying, okay, if they have that early schedule, at least let them peak later in the day with those academic courses.
Absolutely. And I love that there was a conversation about what is best for kids of different ages. And it sounds like from Jeanette's comments, they were taking into account not only the needs of those middle schoolers where this difficulty waking up is really starting to begin to blossom, but they were also thinking about the needs of our elementary kids. That's just great thinking and decision making.
Want to take one more caller before we run out of time. Shauna is with us in Milwaukee. Shauna, hi.
Hi. I was calling to touch base. I've got a slightly different side of things. I work in a residential treatment center for behavior health, and we've got a bunch of teenagers that we work with. And for them specifically, it's very dependent on their specific needs, and I think even broadly for teenagers, it depends on their needs. And so we have kids who have specific medications or they need certain levels of exercise. And so making sure that we recognize that not every kid is resilient.
Shauna, I gotcha. A little tough on the phone line there, but the gist is she works with teens. They have different situations, different needs, different backgrounds. There's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all, Sarah.
And that's what parents need to remember in terms of figuring out what's going to work best for their teen. So, yes, generally sleep hygiene is a good set of strategies, but I think parents have to look at the individual situation of their teens to figure out which particular trigger points are causing the most disruption to sleep, address that. And you know what? The most important thing, talk to your teen and make sure that teenager is involved in being part of the solution.
And Sarah, just in our last few moments, you're trying to draw attention to these issues with this study. Are people listening?
I do think people like Shauna, people like Jeanette and Dan and Mike are thinking about what is best for their kids. A lot of parents are noticing that, yeah, this is a problem in my family too. And what we're really hoping to do with this poll is get people talking about what can they do to make things better in their own family. And if it's appropriate, talk to that healthcare provider next time you go in for a visit about what other strategies you might try.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
That's Sarah Clark, Associate Research Scientist in the Department of Pediatrics and Communicable Diseases at the University of Michigan. She's also co-director of the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital National Poll on Children's Health. We talked with her about the recent Mott poll that showed 28% of teens used medication to help them sleep. You can share your thoughts and experiences with sleepy teens over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Join the conversation already going on over there. Yesterday was a big day for the Milwaukee Bucks. They took a dub over the Sacramento Kings by a resounding 144-109. Giannis scored a triple-double, and there was cheese. Let's focus on that cheese for a moment. In a contest during a break in the action, a lucky fan took on a cheese challenge. The goal, she had to name as many different kinds of cheese as she could in 30 seconds. A true Wisconsin challenge. There's a catch. She had to beat Bucks guard Sterling Brown. His tally was 17 kinds of cheese in a half minute. Could she do it? Here's a sample from a video posted by the Bucks.
Vardy, American, Asiago, Barscapone, Buffalo, smoked Swiss, cream cheese, string cheese, cottage cheese.
She could go all the way. And she did. By the end of 30 seconds, she had named 27 different kinds of cheese. Bonus points for mascarpone there, however you say that. I wouldn't have come up with that one. And now you say, sitting at home and me sitting in the studio, oh yeah, I could pull off 27 kinds of cheese in 30 seconds. It's easy to do, you know, without the clock, without the pressure. I think coming up with 27 in 30 seconds in front of an entire arena full of basketball fans is pretty impressive. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Where did cheese go?
I don't know.
Where did cheese go?